This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get the trustees out the door. 5, 6, 7, 8. Why won't you negotiate?
The teaching faculty at Wright State University walked out on Tuesday morning. Some students, like the ones you just heard, were supportive, but all are impacted. To discuss the strike, its implications for the students and the institution, and the prospects for settlement, we are joined now by the higher education reporter for the Cox Media Group, which includes the Dayton Daily News and WHIO Television and Radio, Max Philby. If you would like to join the discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We are also on Facebook and Twitter. Max, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition. Thank you for coming back. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago as this strike sort of was looming. It's now here. How many faculty actually walked out? How many people are on strike?
So the latest is that we have that about 44% have actually, since this started on Tuesday, crossed the picket line and returned to the classroom. That's out of about 560 or so faculty members represented by the union.
So are you saying 44% of the total faculty or 44% of the bargaining unit went on strike?
Correct. 44% of the bargaining unit. In total, the university has about 1,700 faculty members, give or take.
So some people are crossing the picket line. Some union members are crossing the picket line.
Correct. Yeah. Right now, that number, as of late yesterday, is at about 44%. But there's still a strong contingency of bargaining unit faculty who are out there on the picket line at the entrances to campus today.
So what's happened in the classroom? Several weeks ago when we talked, the school was promising that they would have classes covered by administrators and others. What's actually happening?
Sure. So with the strike starting on Tuesday, they had planned originally to cover most of their classes by either combining them, moving some online, or having them taught by a substitute. Once the strike got started this week, some classes, it appears, were actually left uncovered. Some students were given alternative assignments, such as us being assigned to go take a tour in the library, while other classes that did not have somebody to staff them, students were just dismissed. The university has said that they are trying to fix that situation as the strike continues, and that's something we're keeping a close eye on.
Well, let's say a student goes to a class and it's covered by a substitute teacher who isn't really an expert in that area. They do something. Will the work that they're doing actually be counted? Will it count towards the classwork that needs to be accomplished in this semester?
Sure. So Wright State's president, Cheryl Schrader, has said a number of times that she intends for the classwork that's being completed during the strike to count toward a student's overall grade. Now, we have heard that there have been professors who have told students that they may not count the work that's being done while they're on strike. Ultimately, this is probably all going to depend on how long this thing ends up going for. And, you know, whether or not it's the end of the semester before it's resolved.
Well, they've been on strike since Tuesday morning. Is there any indication that there's any sort of meaningful negotiations going on between the administration, the leadership of the bargaining unit, behind closed doors?
Yeah, not at this point that we've been able to find out about. It appears that both sides pretty much remain dug in on the issues that divide them. There have been a few offers that were made late last week, which both sides refused. And then later today, the school's board of trustees will actually meet to kind of debate what kind of steps should be taken now.
Well, one of the things that I've seen is that the school may ask the state of Ohio, the Employment Relations Board, to declare this strike unauthorized and illegal. What's the basis for that, and can they do that? Is there a prospect that that could be successful?
Sure. So what the university has done is they've asked the State Employment Relations Board, as you said, to declare it unauthorized. And the reason they've done that, there's a number of reasons, but the main one is that according to state law, faculty workload is not something that you can include in collective bargaining. So they say that if the union is using that as one of the reasons why they are on strike, that it therefore would invalidate the strike itself. Now, the university has appealed to the State Employment Relations Board to try to get this declared as an unauthorized strike, but there is no timeline, really, on when or how that will be investigated or resolved. So it could be some time before a decision is even made on that.
So that process, that bureaucratic process, may take longer than actually dealing with the strike. So I would presume in most of these cases, it's best to get people behind closed doors and get them talking. Workload is one of the issues. Furlough days, days that faculty can be furloughed without pay, is another issue. Healthcare is an issue. Are those still – those are the things that you sort of outlined for us a couple of weeks ago. Are those still the issues on the plate?
Yeah, so they're all still big sticking points, I think, for the union. You know, I think when it comes to furloughs, they're worried about how many days they may be furloughed for. And when it comes to healthcare, with what the Board of Trustees implemented earlier this month, they would technically be seeing reduced benefits, the union claims. And they also worry that with this implementation of their now current terms of employment, that it sort of takes away their ability to negotiate healthcare costs and whatnot. So those especially, both of those remain huge sticking points for the union.
So not necessarily salary is not really the issue here.
Correct, yeah. The union leaders have told me that, you know, they really have not expected any sort of monumental raise or anything in the coming years. As I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, Wright State University has been under immense financial pressure in recent years. They had to reduce their budget by about $53 million just a little over a year ago, and they're still kind of digging their way out of that hole.
So given all of that, you know, what is negotiable here in terms of let me shift actually in terms of impact on students. One of your concerns a few weeks ago was how this might impact enrollment. And since the institution is very heavily reliant on tuition payments, is there any indication that students, seeing that this strike may occur, did not enroll? And how long do they have to withdraw this semester and still get money back?
Sure. So the administration has long said that they think this threat of a strike may have already done some damage to enrollment. Wright State's enrollment right now is at something of a historic low. I believe it's below 17,000 for the first time in more than a decade. At its height, it was at 19,000 or so. Now, today was actually originally the deadline for students to withdraw and receive a full refund. But just late last night, the administration announced that they were going to push that back a week to February 1st, so next Friday. So students still have a little bit of time to decide if they want to leave if this thing continues.
Okay. We do have a caller who's called in, and Noah is on the line. Noah, do you have a question?
Yeah, I am a graduate teaching assistant at Wright State University, and my major is such a specialized track within the English department that none of the graduate courses are covered. So we are completely without instruction right now. And I just didn't know if you guys had any information on them getting replacement professors.
I had trouble understanding that, but I think it's a grad assistant who's classes are canceled. Graduate classes are canceled, but I presume they still have to teach. I think that's the question. Max, do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, so the university this week, from what I've heard from students and like that graduate assistant, is that they've all had classes canceled simply because they haven't been able to find somebody to fill in those classes. I have been told that adjunct faculty and others have been asked to help step in and cover those classes, but it's still an issue that the university is dealing with.
So, final question here. Any prospects about how this plays out? Any sense at this point, or are we still really in the early stages of this process?
You know, it's hard to tell because both sides, like I said, just both seem very dug in on the issues. And there haven't really been any conversations that I'm aware of in the last 4 days since this thing began in order to resolve it. So it could be some time here before it's all resolved and the faculty goes back to work.
Well, Max Philby with the Dayton Daily News and WHIO, thank you very much for joining us today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. 13 students were struck by cars in 2018. Gabriela Rodriguez was killed. This week, the Department of Transportation and Engineering informed the city manager that the budget simply does not have the funds necessary to address all the hazardous situations. What are the options? To discuss that, we are joined now by Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Hannah Sparling and WCPO transportation reporter Pat LaFleur. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Hannah, Pat, welcome back. Hannah, you had, within the past week or so, a very powerful interview with the mother of Gabby Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. Just talk a little bit about that before we play a section of that.
So like you said, there were 13 kids hit this past year, but there was one, Gabby, who died. And so we sat down with her mom, Shauna, who's obviously suffering greatly from this. And she's also really, really driven to make sure that her daughter didn't die in vain, that she can make some changes that will hopefully protect some other kids. So we went to her home, sat down with her for a couple hours, and just kind of heard what she had to say about her daughter and then also some changes she would like to make throughout the city.
Okay, let's listen to just a short passage from that interview.
Sebastian called me back a second time. I said, Mom, she's not moving. And I said, Sebastian, I said, what happened? He says, Mom, I'm feeling for a pulse and she's not breathing. There's nothing. She won't move. She was laying on her stomach, and Odell was starting to walk towards her. And he asked her, Gabby, are you okay? And she said, call my mom. And his back was towards oncoming traffic, and the lady was facing him. And that's when the other car came. Never slowed down, never braked. They say they hit her so hard, and you can actually see it in the road. There's an indent that is forever in the road. As it went over, it came down with such force, it actually indented the street.
That's pretty deaf to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, 6 months past?
Yeah, September.
September 10th was mm-hmm. the incident itself. So what does she want to see done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the thing with Gabby, and I think that the thing that makes it a difficult case is Gabby was not in a crosswalk, and she was actually hit by two cars. So the one car knocked her into the other lane, and then the second car hit her and took off. But a lot of things her mom has pointed out is, one, Gabby was wearing all dark clothing, which was her school uniform. Two, it was dark out. You know, she has to be at school at a certain time, and so in the winter, it's dark. So even in places where there are crosswalks, she wants to see better crosswalks, you know, better lighting, flashing lights, things to really make sure drivers know that they need to stop for people there. And where there aren't, maybe just some better lit streets, better sidewalks, and then overall just kind of more enforcement to make sure drivers are looking out more.
Why was she not in a crosswalk? Why was she crossing, not in a crosswalk?
Yes, she was trying to catch her bus on the way to school. She was running a few minutes late. The crosswalk was not in a convenient spot for her. So, I mean, she was a kid. And I think I do this as a 30-year-old. I think we all probably do this. She didn't take the extra time to walk up to a crosswalk and walk. She crossed where she was to try to make it on time to school.
I think to even add to that, I facilitated a discussion on Tuesday, and Denise Driehaus, who has a business on the West Side, said that there are lots of times that high school age kids get dropped off in the middle of a block, and not necessarily at crosswalks, and that she herself had tried to intervene to get Metro to change where they drop students off and didn't get anywhere. So I think we have to recognize that there are structural issues here too. It's not just impulsive running out and trying to catch your bus.
Absolutely. I would say that that is absolutely a part of what's going on here. And concurrently, I think – I don't want to call it coincidentally, but concurrently, Metro is in the middle of – or at the very beginning of a process where they're evaluating their entire network of Metro stops and where they're located. So we're kind of in a position now where we might start seeing some Metro stops being moved closer to crossings, because there are many that are not conveniently located.
And is that sparked by this series of accidents, or is
No, just built in some way? I think that was that's why I wasn't quite sure to use the word coincidental, but it was its own independent effort by Metro just to try to increase reliability of their buses so that they don't get all bunched up. And if there are too many stops along a certain route, that could delay service. But so it's kind of an added benefit that they're already looking at where their stops are located, and they might start assessing where crossings sit in relation to those.
Hannah, on Tuesday, Joe Vogel, the head of the Department of Transportation and Engineering, sent the city manager, Patrick Dehaney, a memo saying, okay, here's our budget for the next 2 years, $500,000 a year. We don't have enough money to structurally address all of the traffic safety problems affecting pedestrians that have been identified. I mean, that's just sort of basics, right? Mm-hmm. What's the implication of that? And I think $500,000 on one level sounds like a lot.
Until you hear how much a crosswalk costs.
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff, it seems like it should be really, really simple, but it's not. And I think basically what he's saying is, you know, this is the problem. This is the amount of money we have. This is how far it'll go. And it doesn't, you know, color in much of what you need. But I think also, you know, you can put a crosswalk down, but of the 13 kids, 8 or 9 were in crosswalks when they were hit. So, I mean, it's not like that paint stops a car. Mm-hmm. So I don't – there's a deeper issue to address.
Yeah, and really quickly to kind of illustrate how much $500,000 toward this stuff really is, we're talking about $500,000 for a single budget cycle. We had Mayor Cranley gave a press conference last Friday where he kind of outlined a number of pedestrian safety improvements that he would back and push towards city council for consideration. What he listed there would have spent all $500,000 of that fund.
Now, I think twice over.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So about half of it was would be from a state grant, and then the other half, about another $500,000, would be from this one-time railway-related fund. So that kind of illustrates how quickly $500,000 can be spent on this issue. But to your point, Hannah, it goes beyond having more crosswalks and more flashing lights. It's definitely a deeper structural issue than that.
Yeah, I do want to point out that on Tuesday at a panel that I moderated, I mentioned before, the city manager mentioned that to put in a crosswalk system and a traffic light, if you got an intersection which needs traffic light system and crosswalks, that's $100,000 at least. So there's you do five of those and you're already at budget. And the list of issues that have to be addressed here is much longer than that. So
I think it was about – they got about 90 requests for 2019.
Right.
And you know, Vogel was very clear about this in his memo. We do not have the money to do all of these things.
Yeah. One of the issues is – and Hannah, you've written about this – is the possibility of a different kind of monitoring with speed cameras. Talk about, first off, how they would work and – then we can talk about what some of the issues are around them.
And I guess up front, this is very, very preliminary. It's against the city charter right now, so that would have to change. But the idea is basically giving police officers a handheld camera, so kind of like a radar gun. But then instead of if a driver goes by and he or she's speeding, instead of a police officer pulling them over in the moment, a ticket just shows up later in the mail. So maybe you think you got away with it, and then you find out later you didn't. Greg Lansman's been pushing this on council. I've seen some positive reaction. I've seen a lot of negative reaction. People don't enjoy being ticketed.
Well, they also don't. Does. They don't enjoy the idea of not knowing that they're being ticketed.
Yeah.
I think is a big part of that pushback.
The surprise after the fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Pat, Hannah just mentioned that this is illegal. Why is this illegal?
Well, so the city charter has language that specifically prohibits certain enforcement devices like this. I'm still familiarizing myself with some of the history, but cameras like these create situations that could put any municipality at risk of being sued. We saw it in New Miami. We saw it in Elmwood Place, where judges ruled that citations issued using – now, these were different kinds of cameras. These were
red light cameras.
Yeah, these are traffic light cameras where there actually isn't an officer involved. And you know, New Miami had to pay taxpayers back about $3 million that the city had collected from them. It's illegal because that's how the charter is written.
Our charter also specifically prohibits an after-the-fact ticket. It has to be issued in the moment at the spot of the violation.
And that is because voters went out and voted that in
yes,
relatively recently against red light cameras.
2010, does that
– That sounds right.
That's about right. And so the point is this is one of those implications of we denied a certain kind of technology and it's in the charter, which for all practical purposes is the city's constitution. This is not just law.
Right.
This is constitution. And the only way it can be overturned is by a vote.
Another voter referendum.
And there are, as I understand it, other cities that are using this technology and have been able to reduce the number of pedestrian accidents in their municipalities. Dayton being one of those, that this can be used. There is a track record here.
That's right. Cities all across the country have been seeing this. And when the issue went before voters, before Cincinnati voters years ago, I'm not sure that as many technological options were on the table at the time. So if Greg Lansman and his team there are going to try to get voters to approve this, there's going to be some work to be done as far as educating the public on the nuances of this because you know, you hear speed camera, it's a very clear image that's conjured in the public's mind, and it's going to be work to change that.
Someone has emailed us, Derek, and wonders if money from traffic enforcement could be earmarked for pedestrian safety.
I believe that's Councilman Lansman's idea, basically, that this money would go specifically to that and not toward anything else.
Okay.
That's correct. Yeah, that's been my understanding with talking with Greg is he wants any sort of revenue from this increase in enforcement to go back toward pedestrian infrastructure improvements.
Okay. So that it would be redlined to go straight into the issue that caused
it. And that would be written into any ordinance that I'm sure he would advance.
Right. And Hannah, you in the Inquirer published an article this week that has a very interesting interactive map on it showing where these accidents took place. there is, first off, in a sort of macro sense, there's a concentration of them in the west side mm-hmm. of the city, particularly along Queen City, but also Harrison mm-hmm. and some in that same area, but especially Queen City, where we got a lot of accidents. What can either of you say about why this concentration in this part of the city? This seems really strange to me that there's not seemingly any distribution beyond this.
Yeah, and I think it's a tough question. You know, I asked Joe Vogel mm-hmm. if he knew why, and he said, no, I don't know. And I asked the school district if they knew why, and they said, no, we don't know yet. I think just going out, we drove around and looked at the different places where these kids were hit, and some of them were in crosswalks with flashing lights and everything like that. So that's kind of – that's difficult to explain. Others were in places where – there's parking sometimes and there's not parking other times, where the sidewalk is right against the street with no kind of buffer in between. And you can kind of see, like, this is not a great spot to be walking. So I think in places like that, there's a clear improvement you could make to keep people safer. For some of the other ones, I just don't know what you could do.
The reality of this problem is that every time a pedestrian is struck, especially in a serious injury case or a fatality, there are a slew of factors that all had to align in a particular way. We're getting to a point where those factors seem to be lining up more and more, leading up to more and more crashes, as has been reported. But as far as geography goes, there are those who argue that the West Side neighborhoods, this is another example of the West Side neighborhoods not getting as much investment from City Hall. Now, I don't know the veracity of that argument, because what I see coming out of the DOTE is improvements.
Department of Transportation and Engineering.
Yeah, Department of Transportation and Engineering is dispersing their projects pretty thoroughly across the city. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the West Side, there are just more people over there. And I'm sure that that plays a role in this as well.
One thing I want to point out, this isn't just about students. Adults are being hit. Mm-hmm. And somebody I think that a lot of people might know, John Eby, mm-hmm. who ran for city council at one point.
I think he's spoken with both of us for reports.
Yeah, I spoke with him recently. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John's a good friend of mine. And he was hit mm-hmm. pretty seriously injured. So this – I don't want to give the impression here that this is just students not sort of understanding things running out.
No, I mean, it's 400-plus adult. I think 454 mm-hmm. hit and 428 crashes.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. That's those are the ballpark numbers. There is research that – shows that, yeah, it is applying to everyone. There are populations, though, that are more vulnerable to this problem, particularly, you know, socioeconomic groups who, you know, people who don't have a car mm-hmm. accessible to them or rely on walking to the bus. So there are social factors at play here also.
Young and old, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a focus on elderly who may not be as – they may not hear as well. They may not hear what's coming. Mm-hmm. They may not move as quick across mm-hmm. a crosswalk. There's all sorts of things. We have a caller who's called in. Mark has a question. Mark, an observation. What do you want to share with us?
Hi. I just wanted to say that when you design a street, if you design it in such a way that it makes it easy to speed, say the lanes are really wide or there's no trees along the roadway, people will speed because they'll drive the speed that they feel comfortable driving. So when you design your street in such a way that discourages fast driving or that makes it feel unsafe to go well over the speed limit, you end up with a street that enforces itself, and you don't need to use as many resources stationing police officers or traffic enforcement.
So this is a question of design, street design, urban design, and using smart urban design to do some traffic slowing and calming. So I think this is certainly a concern that a lot of people and a tool that a lot of people would like to use.
Yeah, there was just a study that came out this – or actually it was an annual report this week from Smart Growth America that looks at how streets are designed, and it ranks the 50 U.S. states on the what they call the danger in their road designs. Ohio did not come up in the top 20 of most dangerous states. I believe Florida was the most dangerous state, and it has been for years. It has a long history of unsafe roadways for pedestrians. But Kentucky clocked in at the 20th most dangerous state as far as road design. But this comes up again and again. But the clearest example we have here locally is what they've done with Hamilton Avenue in Northside. Mm-hmm. Just a remarkable drop in rush hour crashes once simply by lifting some parking restrictions and narrowing the road. So,
and I think that there's a plan to do that on Harrison as well, but mm-hmm. only a stretch in Westwood where John Eby was hit. I know Gabby's mom at least would like that to extend down and just cover the street. And it's going to take people longer to get home or to get to work.
Yeah.
And that's the other side of that. People want streets that move fast. I mean, that's part of the argument about changing liberty, mm-hmm. you know, and there was an effort to narrow liberty, go back to moving fewer cars across that at any one moment.
Theoretically, there's still an effort, although it's been kind of in limbo for a few years now.
Yeah. And, you know, with FC Cincinnati, access to that stadium certainly is a factor that's going to be considered there. So the question is, who owns the street? And, you know, are streets and cities for cars or pedestrians? You know, how do we think this through? And at different times, that has always been a controversial point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a historian, I can go back and tell you that people were furious when streetcars came in and that pedestrians who thought they could walk any place in the street all of a sudden had to deal with vehicles coming down the middle of the street and saw this as an invasion in pedestrian space. Well, that's long gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, streets belong to the cars now, and it's hard to convince people of anything else. So Hannah Sparling and Pat LaFleur, thank you for being here today, as always. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The federal workers who are either furloughed or forced to work without pay, like critical TSA agents and air traffic controllers, missed their second check today. The human ripple effect of that seemed like a temporary inconvenience when it began, but is increasingly obvious 35 days later. To talk about the observable strains of the shutdown on our region, we are joined now by WCPO.com reporter Lucy May. You can join our discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Lucy, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Lucy, I want to start actually not with the partial shutdown, but with a court case that you've been covering this week, and that's the case that is in the Ohio Appeals Court, First Court of Appeals here in Cincinnati, on the issue that was the order that was issued last summer outlawing outdoor homeless camps. Can you talk a little bit about who's brought that to the appeals court? You know, who's arguing on both sides and what the issue is?
Sure. That particular action was brought by lawyers from the ACLU of Ohio representing New Prospect Baptist Church. And the argument is that New Prospect was, what they say is that New Prospect was harmed in the church's ability to serve out its religious mission because it, based on the way they interpret the ban, they could not allow people experiencing homelessness to set up tents on church property. The way they read the ban, they felt like the church would have been in contempt of the ban and could have faced criminal penalties, and that the people that they let camp there, if they had done that, would have also faced arrest and charges. So the ACLU lawyers representing New Prospect Baptist Church are arguing that they have a lot of different arguments. They argue that the lawsuit was kind of a sham and to start with, that Hamilton County sued Cincinnati when both sides wanted the same thing, but they're trying to argue that the ban is improper. And the argument in the appeals courtroom earlier this week was really about whether New Prospect Baptist Church has standing in the case. An assistant prosecutor for Hamilton County argued that the church doesn't have standing because the church didn't have those tents set up and nothing bad happened to the church as a result of all this, and that furthermore, the church has running water and bathrooms and wouldn't, and if they allowed people experiencing homelessness to use those facilities, they wouldn't have had the same public health issues that the judge who issued the ban was concerned about. So it was kind of one of these legal discussions about standing in the case, but the broader issue is whether the ban itself was proper, and the lawyers for the ACLU of Ohio representing New Prospect Baptist Church ultimately would like to see the appeals court get rid of the ban.
Now, is the one of the things that interested me about the argument of the county that New Prospect had these facilities, running water, bathrooms, etc. Were they saying, in effect, that if New Prospect had allowed a tent city to develop there, that the rule that had been put in place banning these sorts of collections that wouldn't have applied and nobody would have done anything about it?
I wish it had been that clear to say whether that's what they were saying or not. And it's one of those times where I was sitting in a courtroom and thinking, man, maybe I should have gone to law school just so I can understand all this. But one of the judges on the three-judge panel kind of asked the assistant county prosecutor a couple times, well, in this part of your brief, it looks like you're saying that the ban doesn't apply to them and it would have been okay for them to do this. But in this other part of your brief, it looks like you're saying that if they had done this, they would have been breaking other kinds of laws. So it was a little bit unclear, honestly, whether, if that hypothetical had happened, whether they would have gotten in trouble or not. Certainly the way New Prospect Baptist Church reads it and their lawyers read it, they would have, and they don't think that the ban should apply to, private property owners and nonprofits who would not be trying to profit off people experiencing homelessness and just would have been able to potentially give them a place to set up their tents while they were, trying to find a better solution.
So is this a situation where the oral arguments have now been made and the three-judge panel is going to make a decision and issue a decision?
Yes, that's exactly it. There were some written filings submitted, and these oral arguments were made, and now the three-judge panel will take that all under advisement and issue a written ruling. It's a little bit unclear when that could come. It could be weeks, it could be months, but yeah, the ball's kind of in their court now.
If I'm not mistaken, there's also a federal case moving on this as well. Is that correct? In a sort of another path?
Yes, you are not mistaken. And Bennett Allen, who's the attorney representing several people experiencing homelessness and the Greater Cincinnati Homeless Coalition in that case, was at the hearing earlier this week. He said he's keeping a close eye on it because he thinks it could have a lot of impact for his clients and other people experiencing homelessness in the county. But yes, that federal lawsuit kind of continues on the slow path that those sometimes take. That argument is the argument for the people who filed that action is that being able to set up a tent when you're experiencing homelessness on a public sidewalk or in a very visible location, they view it as a constitutionally protected form of expression, that's a way to kind of protest the shortage of affordable housing and the lack of available resources for people who need them. And they said that should be viewed as a form of expression and speech, and it should be constitutionally protected.
Besides tracking the legal arguments in this situation, you've also done some reporting about what's happened to the people who were in those camps that were broken up this summer. What can you tell us about where those people have gone? What What's their status at this point?
Well, it's really interesting. Strategies to End Homelessness, which is the nonprofit organization that distributes federal dollars for different homeless services here in Cincinnati and Hamilton County, they had names of, I think it was roughly 40 people who were at the camp at 3rd and Plum Streets that kind of started all the controversy and the discussion over the summer. And they were able to kind of track what happened to those 40 people. Fewer than 10 of them got housing. I believe it was 10 were offered housing, 7 took the housing and were living in housing as far as Strategies to End Homelessness knows. Several after they were offered housing, that kind of fell apart. I think there were some people of the 40 who sort of disappeared. The outreach workers couldn't get in touch with them anymore. Some gave only nicknames or incomplete information that made it difficult to kind of track what had happened to them. So in some ways it's sort of an open question about what happened to all of the people. We were able to interview, I think it was 4 or 5 of the different people who had stayed in those camps. Some of them had gotten housing. We talked to Bison, who became well known as kind of the mayor of the camp at 3rd and Plum Streets, a very outspoken advocate for the people who were staying there. He got housing, but he said he very much feels trapped, and he feels like people aren't getting the help they need and is very, feeling like the city and the community should be doing more to help the people who were in the camps. We also talked to a husband and wife couple that they were still sleeping in their car when we talked to them a couple of weeks ago, and they're trying to get housing. They felt like a few times kind of hassled in their car when they were sleeping in their car, and they'd have authorities kind of knock on the window, and they said they could understand getting some health checks and making sure they were okay, but a couple times they'd had their car completely searched and everything they own now is in the car, so they said it was kind of upsetting. And it's very expensive to keep the car running, so when it gets real cold and they're trying to sleep in a cold car, it can be a tricky situation. So we talked to people who had different outcomes from the whole thing, and also found that systemically, while the city and the community are working to longer-term solutions, there's not a whole lot to show for any big changes that have happened quite yet as a result of that whole controversy over the summer.
Well, one of the things you're raising here is a question of affordable housing. And on another tact here, you've also written recently about the fallout of the partial federal closure on the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, that covers federal housing, and potential implications, not for employees in this case of federal departments, but for residents and who live in HUD-supported housing. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because, for all this time, we've been talking a lot about how the shutdowns impacted federal employees, as we should, because there are a whole lot of them. But I think something that maybe has been a little bit lost in some of the public discussion is the federal government does do stuff. there are programs out there that help a lot of people, and one of them is the what used to be called Section 8, the Housing Choice Voucher Program that helps pay people's rents. So for very low-income people who have an income that's so low they can't afford to pay their entire rent, if they're part of this program, they pay the portion of the rent they can afford. And HUD, here locally, it's in Cincinnati and Hamilton County, they do this through the Cincinnati Metropolitan Housing Authority, HUD pays the rest. So CMHA, as it's known, just sent a letter dated January 22nd earlier this week to participants and property owners who participate in the Housing Choice Voucher Program and said, hey, the bottom line was we have enough money to pay rental subsidies for February, but if the government remains shut down beyond that and we can't get the federal funding we need, we don't know what's going to happen in March. And this affects a lot of households in Hamilton County alone. I just got information from CMHA today that they have more than 11,000 housing units participating in this program, and that's sometimes those are individuals, but often they're families and parents with children, and they are really, really scared. I talked to the director of the Legal Aid Society of Southwest Ohio, John Schreider, who said that Legal Aid has just been inundated with calls from people who got these letters and are worried they are going to lose their homes because these rent subsidies can't be paid. Now, the letter does say that property owners cannot use the lack of the HUD payment for grounds of eviction, so that it should be comforting to the residents, but it doesn't answer the question, okay, well, if the property owners can't evict these people and they don't have real deep pockets to pay their own bills themselves, what happens to them? You know, there are a lot of individual property owners who are involved in this, have this housing and are involved in the program, and not all of them have huge reserves to kind of pay their own mortgages and bills if the federal funds don't come through. So it could be a real giant mess in March if this shutdown doesn't end soon.
Well, I think that's what's interesting here. It's not just the people living in Section 8. It's the people who own housing that is supported through these choice vouchers who will be affected here. And we're beginning to see sort of longer range spill-offs of the partial shutdown.
Right, exactly. Because, you know, some of these, if you've got an apartment and you're renting it like just for the sake of round numbers, because I'm bad at math, if your rental rate is $1,000 a month, and maybe the person you're renting to can only afford $200 a month because that's 30% of their income, well, then the federal government's making up the rest. And if I own a property, it's awfully hard to come up with that extra, you know, $800 a month, even for 1 month, unless I have a big cushion. And, you know, property owners, they typically have mortgages to pay and debts to pay and their own bills and operating costs. So, yeah, this could go well beyond the low-income people who are served by these programs and have big ripple effects.
Well, Lucy May, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for the reporting. Sort of broadens out our view of who's being impacted by this shutdown. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.